Okay, I'm going to be picking up here with where I left off. The question came up as I was leaving, parting company, and that was business of a person who has chronic bronchitis, or a bronchitis, a form of bronchitis, let's say, every winter or sometime during the year, but the rest of the year they're okay. That does not qualify as chronic bronchitis. It's not going to lead to the problems of COPD. That is recurrent. The chronic bronchitis means it really does. It stews on and on. It's unremitting, and it goes for 24/7 for years. That's the big difference here. Okay, let's take a look at restrictive lung disease. In the case of restrictive lung disease, the problem is the lung can't really move. It's trapped, and it can get trapped in a variety of ways. It can happen rather acutely as a surfactant problem, and this we refer to as acute respiratory distress syndrome. In the case of premature infants, the term is used, hyaline membrane disease. So we have acute and chronic. I want to say just a few words about acute, and then we'll look at chronic things. In the case of acute injury, the problem is typically something has damaged the endothelial cells. It's an overwhelming gram-negative infection, something like that, shock, a variety of things that will injure these endothelial cells such that there's leakage of proteins into the alveolar space. And proteins then combine with the surfactant that's out there, and there also may be some damage to the type 2 pneumocytes so that they're not producing enough surfactant, but the surfactant then becomes kind of glommed together with the proteins, and the end result will be this very thickened rind in within the alveolar space of this kind of protein hyalinized protein surfactant combination. The hyalinized means what it looks like microscopically. And it increases the distance between the alveolar lumen and obviously the capillary, and it also makes the capillary or the alveolar space very rigid so that it's difficult to either inhale or exhale. And this is almost always then a consequence in adults of some kind of overwhelming infection or traumatic injury or severe blood loss that led to injury somehow to the endothelial cells and subsequent leakage of proteins. Now, in the case of a newborn, and this is what's being demonstrated here, by the way, we're looking at inflammatory cells, maybe antigens determined that are bound on the surface of the endothelial cells, like bacterial wall fragments or something. And then you have this leakage of proteins and complexing with the surfactant, which leads to this hyaline membrane. And that's what it looks like microscopically. It's kind of pink staining. It not only makes the alveolus non-compliant, difficult to move, it also reduces the ability to move oxygen and CO2 across there. Adult respiratory distress syndrome, ARDS, it's often referred to as, and it's a complication of something. Someone just doesn't waltz in and say, hey, I think I'm coming down with ARDS here. It's always a complication of some disastrous condition. This is what it looks like with the alveolar spaces with this pink staining, bright pink staining goo kind of lining the alveoli. Now, in the case of premature infants, they don't have any surfactant or very little surfactant. the end result is that the alveoli will collapse, and then there is true hypoxia not only of every organ but also the lung, and then you have injury to the capillary and the lung tissue, leakage of proteins, and then the congealing of the protein goo in the alveolar space, again making the alveolus very rigid and also decreasing the ability to move oxygen. So in the case of a newborn infant, we use the term hyaline membrane disease. I would say premature infant, we would use that. We can actually blow the surfactant in there, but we can't really make the lung hyper-develop. If they really are quite premature, they simply don't have alveolar spaces yet developed and so on. So that's a form of acute injury. Chronic restrictive lung disease, a whole variety of things that will do that, and basically what's happening is we have scar tissue forming within the lung, and then the scar tissue makes the lung rigid so that it's not pliable and it can't move when the chest increases in diameter and you're trying to go through an inhalation episode. occupational things, asbestos, silica, the silicosis here in our part of the world, coal miner's lung. These are all particulates that go, the little bitty fragments will go all the way out there and lead to chronic injury and lots of fibrosis and scarring. There's a chemotherapeutic agent called busulfan that some people react to that will cause pulmonary fibrosis. Other conditions that are associated with pulmonary fibrosis and scarring within the lung tissue are related to chronic immunologic conditions such as rheumatoid arthritis and others that involve the skin and connective tissue like scleroderma. Sarcoid we'll come to, I think, in a moment here. I think I have some pictures of sarcoid. And then sometimes it occurs and we have no idea what's driving it. It's just the lung tissue begins to scar down on itself and eventually it can't move and the alveolar spaces are disappearing. If we're taking a look here at whatever the stimulus is, whether it's particulate in nature or something else, the macrophages, remember, are the guys who are basically giving the signals to the inflammatory cells and particularly fibroblasts to maintain or continue with an inflammatory reaction, and in the case of fibroblastic stimulation, to produce collagen. And if there's a prolonged activation of these, you're going to have a lot of collagen produced. And if you have particulates out there that you cannot get rid of, then there's going to be extraordinary over the years. Now we're talking about something that takes years to develop, a production of collagen. You see, the little silica dust is kind of like this. Imagine you chew a big wad of chewing gum, and you got this gooey mess of chewing gum, and you take that out of your mouth, and then you stick scalpel blades in it so they're pointed out. I mean, it's like a Death Star. Well, that's what these little silica fragments are like. When they get stuck out in the lung, every time you inhale, it cuts. The little knives cut something. And here's an example of tremendous amount of scar tissue, a hard granuloma, as it's called, within the lung. And you might say, well, that doesn't look like it destroys a lot of lung tissue. Well, that one didn't. But you add up a billion of those things, or billions upon billions of those things, and yes, you do over time lose a lot of lung tissue. The process here of particulates is the same with coal miner's lung and silica and so on. Here's one which is sarcoidosis. This is a scarring process that is not restricted to the lung. There very likely is some kind of infectious agent. I don't know. There's something that triggers it. And it's showing this. It occurs more frequently in people of at least recent African descent. It will involve the glands of the eyes, such as you see here, tear glands. It involves sweat glands. It involves lung tissue, heart. Variety of things are involved, and it's a granulomatous, and it looks kind of, these are hard granulomas. They don't have a caseous center. Here's an example of one with a lot of giant cells. You can see big giant cells right in the middle here, but lots of those, and that will lead to extensive fibrosis and scarring within the lung. There's also something called hypersensitivity pneumonitis that can lead to scarring, or it can lead to a lot of edema and so forth in the lungs. In this situation, we might actually get the lung colonized in this case, it could be particulates from the farm. Say, this is one thing that we see with people who don't wear masks and work in the cotton industry. They get exposed to cotton fibers. But you can also get exposed to fungal spores, which may get all the way out into the alveoli, and then you end up with a reaction to those in the alveolar spaces and lots of scarring. And that's what's being depicted here, is the fungal growth. But it is a profound hypersensitivity reaction to that. Here we'd be looking at something that might be more related to the scarring we would see with exposure to cotton fibers or something, although there's happened to show cryptococcal or something in there. And so the long-term effect of that with a farm exposure either to dust or to fragments of plant matter can also lead to a condition quite similar to what we see with exposure to, say, silica dust or coal dust. The idiopathic pulmonary fibrosis, so we don't know all the stuff that drives that. Some people just get it. They basically scar their lungs away to nothing, and then that's the end of it. There is no very little in the way of alveolar spaces left. Notice this person is also demonstrating clubbing of the fingers. We talked about that with respect to the right to left pulmonary shunts. Okay, vascular-related conditions. Obviously, we have a lot of blood vessels in the lungs. If we have a lot of space, alveolar space of a whole football field, well, we also got miles and miles of capillaries to be associated with those, alveolar space. And so having a patent vascular system and having good flow through the lungs is important for gas exchange to occur. What do we see in the way of this? Well, we can have backup of blood into the pulmonary system if we have a failing left side of the heart. We can get vascular congestion, and the pressure within the vascular system can exceed the oncotic pressure and literally push fluid right out into the lung tissue, and that's known as pulmonary edema. We can have catastrophic events where large parts of the arterial system of the lung gets occluded from, say, a pulmonary embolus. Somebody that's been on a long airplane flight, or they have some other problem that potentially leads to clot formation in their legs or even arms, that those clots can move into the lungs, and then obviously they can't go through because they're too small. We've already talked about one of the things that happens, which is a vascular response to increased pressure. Recall back when we talked about left to right shunts in a ventricular septal defect back with the heart disease, congenital heart problems, where you have increased pressure in what's really designed to be a low pressure system. The vessels undergo a reactive hyperplasia known as Eisenmenger's reaction, and the end result is that the blood vessels become very thick walled and the lumens get smaller and smaller, and so you actually have a decreased amount of blood flowing through. And there obviously are changes in the right side of the heart to try and overcome that, but they can't really, and leading to the pulmonary hypertension and decreased blood flow and poor oxygenation. There's what's called primary pulmonary hypertension, which appears in some people to be due to a particular herpes virus, herpes virus 8. Other things that would lead to vascular injury, chronic vascular injury, would be autoimmune conditions, where we have autoimmune injury, either antigen antibody mediated or T cell mediated injury to the vessels, maybe all over the body, but certainly in the lungs, which will lead to them becoming inflamed and scarred, so forth. Let's take a look at some of these. Here's pulmonary edema. This is an autopsy section showing fluid just, this is from a lung, it's been cut open and we're looking into a bronchus, and you can see all the fluid just bubbling out of this. This could be someone who died of a cardiac death, and all the blood got backed up into the lungs, and as they were dying, they were basically, the fluid was being extravasated through the wall of the vessel. Here's a pulmonary embolus, blood clot that probably arose in the leg and moved into the lungs. And you can see here it's completely occluded the major vessel. Well, if that's the case, your number's up. Now here's a pulmonary infarction. Even though we can have clots in the lung, we don't always have infarctions. Here's the blood clot, by the way, and here's the area where the lung has died. And it has bled into it a little bit because the lung has the unique situation of a double circulation. Blood flows, comes from the venous return, but also we have arterial blood coming from what's called the bronchial artery system. And if there's a obstruction in one, the other might bring enough oxygenated blood to keep the lung tissue alive. If you already have some coexisting disease, an older person who has atherosclerosis, okay, well here we go ahead. Had a little interruption, so I'm not quite sure where I was with this, but this is a pulmonary infarct, and I think I was talking about the dual blood supply. What we have, the reason it's hemorrhagic is that if one of the two is occluded and the other is kind of diseased, that is to say the pulmonary artery system becomes occluded with a pulmonary embolus. Here's the blood clot, and it migrated there from somewhere else through the right heart. But if there's also atherosclerosis and stuff like that in the bronchial arteries, which kind of supply the actual arterial blood to the lung tissue, well then you do end up with a dead tissue. But if there's a trickle of blood, and often we will see that, then as the tissue starts to break down, that includes the blood vessels breaking down as well, and then you do have leakage of blood into the pulmonary tissue. And for that reason, pulmonary infarcts tend to be hemorrhagic. All right. Well, also I mentioned, again, we're talking about vascular disease and things that ultimately will change the dynamic of blood being able to flow through the blood vessels. And here's an example of a ventricular septal defect, which of course is going to have left to right shunt, and it will beat up the pulmonary arteries and arterioles. This Eisenmenger reaction occurs, and eventually the shunt will probably reverse itself if it's large enough. But what the vessels themselves look like will be something like this, where we see this incredible onion skinning hyperplasia of these smaller blood vessels, and as the muscular wall undergoes this reactive hypertrophy, the lumen becomes smaller and smaller. This over here is an interesting picture, and this is something where we see the almost like new blood vessel growth. And this is something that we can see either with bad pulmonary hypertension or following that infection with the herpes 8 virus. And how that drives that to work, I'm not quite sure. All right, let's go ahead and take a look at pulmonary infections now. And again, pulmonary infections means everything from your nose all the way down into the alveolar spaces. We're going to deal with just a couple of examples here. If we have infections of the actual, with the infectious material, and exudate is in the alveolar spaces, that's known as a pneumonia. And we can also have a pneumonia in which the inflammatory stuff is in the interstitial tissue, that is, the connective tissue between the alveolar spaces. And when we see a pneumonia with the junk in the space, it tends to be bacterial in nature, or it's almost always bacterial in nature. Viruses tend to like to subsist in the connective tissue between them. Not all of them follow that rule, but most do. We can also have abscesses, and this we might see in somebody who has really bad teeth or they aspirate. In other words, maybe they've got a neurological condition, so they can't swallow well, and they aspirate, or they're drunk, they're alcoholics, and they spend a lot of time with their head down in the gutter, in which case the infectious organisms that they tend to aspirate or suck down if they barf and then suck the barf down into their trachea. These would be upper respiratory bugs and things like that. Sort of normal flora almost. Bronchitis means just that, inflammation of the bronchial system. Bronchiolitis means inflammation of the terminal airways, the very smallest of the bronchioles. Tend to see this in pediatrics, and it tends to be related to viruses. And then if we even move out of the lung, we're looking at pleuritis, and that is inflammation which might be infectious in nature, but more often than not is actually toxic or due to some other systemic problem where the pleura becomes secondarily inflamed. Here's an example of, we see two different kinds of pneumonia, lobar pneumonia and bronchopneumonia. In bronchopneumonia, the inflammatory infiltrate tends to concentrate itself around the bronchi, and that's what we see. In lobar pneumonia, the bugs will spread through the little pores of Kahn. Those were the pores that are used to equalize the pressure between alveoli next to one another. And pneumococcus is the one that's so notorious for causing this. And it shows the entire lobe is involved as opposed to kind of spotty nature like this. People are still sick. I mean, this is really a bad deal. And in this case, again, it's bacterial in nature, and it's the alveolus that contains the bacteria and the inflammatory exudate and junk like that. And so what we're looking at here would be bugs and bacteria all the way out in the alveoli, getting in inflammatory cells and stuff. And the alveolus basically fills up with the exudate and basically is removed from, from a gas exchange. Now, depending on the bacteria, we may have complete recovery. Pneumococcus, for example, really doesn't destroy the lung tissue. It just occupies the alveolar space. When the pneumococcus organism is gone, pretty much full function is returned. But with other bacteria, there is digestion of the lung tissue leading to an abscess, something like that. And you can see that, of course, the junk, the exudate, may get whisked up into the lymph nodes. Here's an example of pneumococcal pneumonia. And a couple of different pictures of it. And so here we see a whole lobe involved. Over here it's a little bit spottier, but the x-ray looks like it's a pretty significant amount of involvement there. And again, if it's streptococcus and people recover from it, that's the trick. The lung tissue is really not destroyed. has just been occupied. The alveolar space has been occupied. Here we're taking a look at an example of that, and it's kind of hard to see, but here are the outlines of the alveolar walls, and you can see that everything is filled with acute inflammatory cells. So that alveolus really wasn't contributing in any way to gas exchange. Now, if we have mixed floral infections or opportunistic bugs like oral flora, that can really be a serious problem, because those bugs do have the capability, at least in a mixed environment, a capability of destroying the tissue. Where do we see this? Again, lifestyle or other problems contribute to this situation. Again, a person who has trouble swallowing. Maybe they've got Parkinson's disease or some other neurological problem, amyotrophic lateral sclerosis, Lou Gehrig's disease, and they can't swallow. In fact, pneumonia tends to be the most common cause of death for people with neurological problems like Parkinson's and ALS. The reason is that if they can't swallow right, when they try to, stuff goes down in the trachea and they may not cough it back up, and it carries the bacteria with it. In this case, it may be perfectly normal oral flora, it's just that they're out of their location. That's the opportunity that they seize. And so opportunistic infection could be that. A compromised host can be a variety of things. Chemotherapy, or they've got some surgical intervention like a tracheostomy, or they're alcoholic, in which case they have a greater likelihood of aspirating again into the trachea if they're barfing or they're passed out, and then you introduce bacteria, which are normally part of the thing. Here's an example of a bacteria that we see often in alcoholics, Klebsiella. Klebsiella is a gut floral organism in some people. Here you can see this very soupy, goopy nature of the bacteria in the on the culture plate. But again, alcoholics spend a lot of time with their head down in the gutter, which is to say, that's my way of saying, they throw up, they're passed out, and they aspirate GI material, or they aspirate oral flora. In fact, that's where they're going to get this bug from. It's one of the gram-negative rods that we have in our GI tract. Very high fever, very sick, can lead to an abscess. Now here is an abscess. This could be a mixed floral infection or a staphylococcus. Staph can certainly do this. They destroy the tissue, and we'd see on x-ray kind of an air fluid level, a meniscus. And here in x-ray you can see that here's a hole in the lung, and here is all the fluid. If the person is standing up, the fluid, the goop, the pus, this is what you'd squeeze out of a zit, for example, will all end up down here, and we'll actually see an air fluid meniscus level. That's totally destroyed lung tissue. That is not coming back. And so there's a problem there. That's what we mean by an air fluid level if the person is at least standing up when you get the x-ray. Fungal infections and pneumonias are decidedly uncommon outside of people who are immune suppressed, whether it is, at least serious ones, whether it is HIV or chemotherapy. I'd say with the one exception, or several exceptions, but one is histoplasmosis, which is extremely common in the Ohio-Mississippi River Valley area. But those of us who have competent immune systems, it basically infects us, we nail it, we wall it off in a granuloma, and that's the end of the story. And it will basically die in there. So, but in people who are really compromised, that may be otherwise. So fungal infections are not usual, at least serious fungal infections, even though many of us, I'm sure I probably have, I've lived here all my life, I'm probably sure I have histoplasmosis in some kind of lockdown phase in my lungs. Histoplasmosis in the immune compromised person now can spread widely. Now we're looking at something quite a bit different here. The person who has HIV or chemotherapy, we can see it becoming a skin infection, we can see it becoming an oral infection, a pneumonia, disseminated throughout the body involving the spleen and the liver. So it is a completely different beast, behaves differently obviously in someone who's immune suppressed. And here we see a macrophage containing the organisms, and they're busy proliferating within there. Pneumocystis carinii is has been changed, now it's Jarovecki, but Pneumocystis Jarovecki or Jarovecki carinii or something, it gets named every now and then, renamed. This would be in immune suppressed people. It became evident and was known in orphanages after World War II, orphanages in Europe, where kids were extremely malnourished and as a consequence of the starvation were immune suppressed. So you don't have to have immune suppression really due to just HIV or chemotherapy. It can occur for other reasons. And this infection is caused by an organism that is in and around us all the time. This bug, every inhalation that you take, you breathe in pneumocystis. It's just there. But in the immune competent person, it can't do anything. So this is looking at a variety of circumstances in which this proliferates. The bug proliferates out in the alveolus, and it's very hard to get the bug to come up, to cough it up. So we have to actually wash it out of the lung to make the diagnosis. It's actually easily treated. Common antibiotics will take care of it. It's just you have to suspect it and recognize it and have it done. Let's take a look at tuberculosis. This is worldwide an extremely common infection. Many people, in fact, a third of the world's population are infected with tuberculosis. That doesn't mean they have something that's destroying their lungs or the rest of their body. The initial infection may, in most cases, gets walled off and nailed down, and that's where it stops. But the TB bug can survive in a granuloma for decades, and it may reactivate in what we call secondary tuberculosis. So when we say a third of the world's population is infected with it, it means they have it, they're carrying it, it's in some stable form and lockdown form in their lungs. Doesn't mean that they're dying sick with it, but under certain circumstances it may become activated because the bug just can hang on ad infinitum. Here is a carving showing somebody who's emaciated, and this disease was known as consumption because of the way that people died with it when it did become reactivated, or in the event that they didn't have such a good immune system from the get-go, and the bug just continued to proliferate. So we talk about primary and secondary infections. Remember, this is handled by the type 4 hypersensitivity reaction to produce a granuloma. Let's take a look at that. Here's our primary infection. And what we're going to do is, with the joining piece that exists between the tuberculous organism, the CD4 lymphocyte, and the macrophage, the instructions will be, let's make a granuloma. We aren't probably going to be able to kill this sucker. And so you build a jail cell around it. That's the whole idea of the granuloma. And it develops caseous necrosis in the middle of it in the case of tuberculous organism. But that sucker can actually survive in there for decades. Now, let's suppose that 10 years down the road, the person becomes malnourished, or they develop HIV or something like that, and all of a sudden now their immune system goes to hell, and so they wind up with reactivation, and it's internal. Yeah, it's possible to get reinfected with it, and in fact, when we see people with overwhelming tuberculosis, they may have two or three different strains of the organism. But at any rate, this will be a secondary. This is showing the primary. You can see grayed out is the secondary activation. So here's the secondary reactivation, in which case it may easily spread all over the body, cause a person to die. So tuberculosis is an important thing. It's our immune system that does all the damage, really. It's a super duper overreaction to it. I'm sure the bug would proliferate and eventually kill us, but it's the immune system that causes all the damage. And what these pictures are showing here are little granulomas that are scattered all over the place. Here's an example x-ray showing the caseous area, or the cavitary areas. This would be in someone, say, who contracted it and was immune suppressed, or for whatever reason didn't have a competent immune system to deal with it, or a very highly aggressive strain of tuberculosis. And the holes and the rotten areas here really result from the person's own hypersensitivity, the overreaction on the part of the macrophages. Over here we're seeing the caseous necrosis and lymph nodes in the pulmonary, the actual picture. Here we can see the areas of holes in the lung. You can see that right there. And those are areas of cavitation. We use that term very cautiously in medicine because it means tuberculosis so many times. Here's an example of granuloma looking at caseous necrosis and giant cells. The bug, again, is relatively inert, and it just stimulates our immune system to go absolutely bonkers. Here is showing, this is a spleen, section of a spleen with all these little white things in it. This is known as miliary tuberculosis. Not military, but miliary, and really it just means it's spread and when you all over, and when we see a section of a lung or liver or even brain, we look at these little granulomas and they look like millet seeds. It's not a special strain or variety, it's just the fact that the thing spread that way. There are a variety of ways of diagnosing it. We often do PPD skin testing. And this has to be read in 2 days. And we measure the swelling, not the redness. Everybody gets some redness. But we measure the swelling, the so-called induration or swelling related to the injection site. My guess is you had this done. So tuberculosis, very important kind of thing, can infect every part of the body, bones and brain and the works, but it is a T4 hypersensitivity reaction, really does a lot of the damage. Here's a viral infection of the lung, CMV, which actually cytomegalic inclusion virus. It can infect all over the place. Generally, we see it in immune-suppressed people. It has this highly characteristic owl-eyed kind of inclusion within the inflammatory cells. HIV and chemotherapy suppression, typically where we see it. And again, this can infect every cell in the body. It probably affects the type 1 and type 2 pneumocytes as well as everything else out there. Let's go on and talk about lung tumors here. When we talk about a tumor, really the first thing is we often diagnose is there a mass on an x-ray. Well, a mass on an x-ray can be a granuloma, or it can even be a congenital rest with a little ball of cartilage and not a tumor or malignancy at all. So we have to be careful how we use that term. So a mass on an x-ray, a spot on that film, may not be a malignancy. And in lungs, you can have benign tumors of the lung and malignant tumors of the lung. And you can have tumors that spread to the lung. I'm sure you're aware of the fact that breast cancer, renal cancer, and so on, can spread to the lung. We're going to look essentially at primary tumors here. But when we use the term, there's a mass on x-ray, it can be a variety of things. Well, benign tumors of the lung are pretty doggone rare and typically come from supportive structures such as the vessels, the smooth muscle in the vessel, or the cartilage. And we'll see a little ball or a little collection of cells. I don't know of any benign, truly benign tumor that comes from respiratory epithelium. The ones that we refer to here are hamartomas, which means the hamartoma is a tumor composed of tissue, one type of cell, and it is something that you normally find there, but you don't find it growing independently. But it's benign. Remember, the difference between benign and malignant is that it spreads. Malignant will spread. Now, malignant tumors, the vast majority of them come from the bronchial epithelium. And we use the term bronchiogenic epithelium, the lining of the airways. And some may come from the little terminal cells that go into the alveolus. And occasionally we see some arising from the mucin-secreting cells or even endocrine active cells in there, but most of it is from bronchiogenic. Cigarette smoking is a major factor here, asbestos exposure, a variety of things, radiation. We don't think about radiation if you're around here, but out on the East Coast, there is actually a lot of radioactive gas that comes up from the lava that basically Eastern Canada is situated over. I mean, it's not liquid lava, obviously. It's a so-called Canadian shield. So you can get it from a variety of sources, radiation exposure, radioactive gases. But carcinoma of the lung coming from bronchial epithelium secondary to cigarette smoke injury is the most common kind of thing. Most of these are squamous cells, not all, about 50-50 squamous cells and adenocarcinomas or glandular carcinomas. And you might think, hey, the news is there's no squamous epithelium out there in those bronchi. That's true in a healthy person, but in the cigarette smoker, they have these epithelial cells will undergo metaplasia and transform into a squamous epithelial cell simply because of the chronic injury from the cigarette smoke. Chronic injury now to these metaplastic squamous cells may lead to a malignancy that is a squamous cell, and you would think otherwise would have come from the skin. So these are very aggressive. Really, there's no chemotherapy that works. It's either surgically corrected or it's not, if they're going to die with it. This shows one here with metastasis to lymph nodes there centrally. Here's some exfoliatocytology. In other words, people can cough up. And here we see these big malignant strap cells, the long skinny things with central bizarre looking nucleus and eosinophilic staining cytoplasm. This is bronchiogenic squamous cell. This over here is a small cell carcinoma. It's still lethal. This comes from neuroendocrine cells and they don't have a squamous differentiation. But they are present there in the lung. They are this can occur in people who are non-smokers. Here's an acute inflammatory cell, and again, if you will take a look, compare that nucleus of any one of these cells. Here's a nucleus of a small cell. You might think, holy Toledo, that's really a big cell. That's true, but compared to squamous cells, they're small. This nucleus alone is much larger than this entire inflammatory cell. So just using that as a standard, you can see these actually are very big and bizarre cells. I want you to know that that some of these malignancies will produce oddball things. They may produce agents that will be recognized, endocrine agents and so forth. I want you to know the difference between the two major ones. Here's the basic patterns of carcinoma that we see here. Squamous cell carcinoma. This is adenocarcinoma. This is the small cell cancer that we were just looking at. They look kind of like bizarre lymphocytes. And this is called alveolar cell. This actually comes from the terminal bronchiole epithelial cells, as it's sort of the group of cells that transition into the epithelium within the actual airway, the alveolar space itself. Most of the cancers are one of either squamous cell or adenocarcinomas, and these are the smaller percentage of these guys down here. They're all related to cigarette smoking or radon gas exposure. That is the that's the one that's that we find coming out of the lava formations out in the East Coast. Old lava formations. Here would be some examples of things that lung cancer can do. Since it can spread widely, it can spread to the brain, and every now and then we'll see somebody who presents at the age of 65 with a seizure. They're brought in, they just had a seizure, grand mal seizure, and it turns out it's because of a cerebral metastasis. So it can cause pneumonia by means of obstructing the bronchus. That may be how they give out. Often they have blood associated with them, and the person coughs that up. There are two different or three different hormones that can be manufactured by these. The small cells make an antidiuretic hormone, ADH, and they can also make ACTH. And they don't consistently do it, but that's something that they will do. The other one, which is an interesting one, squamous cell is known for producing parathyroid hormone. And it's not a so I want you to keep those two straight. I always ask the difference. Do you know which one produces which? So be prepared for that. But a small cell carcinoma can produce ACTH, so a person can actually present with what looks like Cushing's syndrome. Granted, something we haven't talked about yet, but we will with in the endocrine system. Even some people generate symptoms that are neurological, like mobile sclerosis kind of symptoms, or myasthenia gravis symptoms, where there's weakness of muscle, but it's not related to metastasis. This guy over here is demonstrating what's called Pancoast tumor. The Pancoast tumor shows Horner's syndrome, drooping eye, and a dry eye. And what that is related to is the location of the tumor. It's not a special tumor. Most of those tumors are squamous cell carcinomas. But when it arises up here in the apex of the lung, it can involve the sympathetic nerve roots. And remember that the sympathetic nerves have some involvement, go up the here to involve innervation, well, at least to the lacrimal glands, and they have kind of an odd-shaped iris. They often have pain because of the involvement of the nerves down here that go into the arm. That's all part of this Pancoast tumor. It just, he got his name added to it because of these other things that are seen related to the compressional effect or destructive effect of tissue surrounding the lung. Well, the most common tumor in the lung actually came from someplace else. Here's an example of metastatic cancer. metastatic cancer, because it can come from the breast, it can come from the colon, it can come from the stomach, it can come, you know, they spread there. Just to go back here for a minute to take a look at cigarette-induced, tobacco-induced cancers or radon gas-induced cancers. let's, well, in the case of cigarette smoking, you might say, well, because you smoke cigarettes, does that mean you're going to die with cancer? And the answer is no. In fact, the odds are overwhelming. You're not going to die with cancer if you're a cigarette smoker, at least cancer of the lung. Only about 1 in 2,000 cigarette smokers come down with lung cancer. But all the lung cancers, effectively, are either in cigarette smokers or people who have substantial exposure to radon gas. So it's one of the risks of smoking, but does it mean you're going to develop cancer? No. What do cigarette smokers die of? They all die early, by the way, about 8 years. Most cigarette smokers will die almost a decade, about 8 years earlier than non-smokers, and they die with pulmonary-related conditions. Emphysema, chronic bronchitis, they also have accelerated atherosclerosis, so they die with heart attacks. The most common cause of death with a cigarette smoker would be pulmonary-related, but not necessarily cancer. So these are showing the spread of lung cancer, of cancer into the lung from someplace else. Now the pleura, I mentioned this before, the pleura is what surfaces the lung and is the surface inside the chest cavity, surrounds the lung. And we can have injury such that we have air leakage in and the pleural space basically becomes loaded with air and the lung will separate and compress. Or we can have blood or other things. This is showing what's called a pneumothorax. Pneumo meaning air. We have a pneumothorax, air coming in through a puncture in the chest wall. And the lung will deflate, or we could have air coming from a rupture of the lung. Some kind of a bleb or a cyst or something on the surface of the lung can lead to air in here, and that doesn't have to have a hole in the chest wall. And as the air accumulates, it not only causes the lung to go down, it may compress everything to the other side, which is a disaster because it compresses the lung, moves the heart over, and we have to get that air out of there and reinflate the lung. So one thing would be air in there. You could have blood in the case of injury. We can have infections and fluid. You can have fluid accumulate in here because of heart failure. So there are a variety of things that will lead to fluid accumulation. So air is one thing, but we can have a sterile pericarditis in the case of renal failure. We can have bacterial involvement. Certainly Lyme disease and viral infections can involve the pleural surface. And then, of course, blood from injury and just straight-out fluid, so-called hydrothorax, when we have somebody who has heart failure and fluid is accumulating there for that reason. That's different than pulmonary edema. Tumors in the, involving the surface of the lung, the pleural surface, are pretty uncommon. About the only primary tumor is a mesothelioma, which has a very strong association with asbestos workers and smoking both, but asbestos workers particularly. And there's a malignant proliferation of the cells that line that pleural space. Some tumors will metastasize there, either directly, if it's in a case of a lung cancer, it can spread by just contiguous growth there, or it can be seeded in there, and we'll see that seeding occur with others such as breast cancer and so forth. It's kind of unusual, but it does happen. So you can actually have metastatic from about any place. The only primary one is a mesothelioma. Lastly, allergic upper airway disease. This is just something I want to think about. Sinuses. We can have bacterial infections of the upper airway, such as the sinuses, and those typically occur in association with allergic disease as well. When you have an allergic reaction, say to pollens or mold or something like that, leaf matter, there's a lot of swelling of the tissue, which means that the sinuses can't empty. Your sinuses have to be able to drain. They make mucus. This stuff is in there. It's not sterile. And so part of the effect here is to be able to be sure that the mucus and junk can get out of your sinuses. And so if you have a sinusitis initially on the basis of inflammation from allergic disease, you can actually end up getting a secondary bacterial infection simply because the little orifices that are there where things are going to drain out swell up and clot and plug up, and so the bacteria can just keep on growing. So we can have allergic and infectious conditions of the sinuses. Obviously, we can have allergic and infectious problems of the larynx. The upper airway swelling there can lead to complete occlusion. In the case of a child, involvement of the larynx or the epiglottis can lead to complete airway occlusion there. But I'm sure everybody's had some form of laryngitis. So you can have infections. Viruses are by far the most common. We can develop squamous cancer. And again, smokers are the ones who get squamous cancer there. Also, people who have had Epstein-Barr viral infections can develop cancers of the larynx and upper airway. People can develop polyps and injury from yelling real loud, believe it or not. They can have areas of hemorrhage and injury to the vocal cords. And if they do that repeatedly, that you may develop redundancy of the mucosa. You can also have polyps forming because of viral infection, such as human papillomavirus infection. So those are things that can happen in the upper airway involving sinuses and larynx and so forth. And I think